You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where the clown sighting epidemic is a performance art piece about the presidential election. If you enjoy your trip into the midside today, please tell a friend. Referrals are our number one source of tourism. And if you'd like to tip your tour guides, feel free to use Patreon. Joining us this trip via Skype from Patriots Nation Capital, Daniel T. Richards. How are you enjoying the land of the New England Patriots, Daniel?
It's hard to park my car, but other than that, it's delightful. It's nice. I'm in Boston for the week hanging out before Justin and I go to a Patriots game. It's fantastic. It's also why I'm speaking sort of low in a hushed tone. I'm at an Airbnb and I don't want to be too disruptive of my host.
The only person in the world who goes to Boston and doesn't want to be disruptive.
Indeed. But I love Boston. I've been here one other time just for one day. It's a beautiful city. I'm super into American history. So I'm basically going to spend the week, other than working, I'm working from here. But so in my free time, though, I'm going to spend the week walking the Freedom Trail and reading every goddamn sign that exists. Because FISA's not with me. We take one separate vacation every year so that we sort of don't kill each other. And this is one thing that she and I just do not have in common. I like to read every plaque in a museum. I will stay there for all day. And she's on to the next John Wick movie. So,
which, if you heard, they're going to do a third one, apparently. It's already in pre-production.
2, 3, 5, I can't count anymore. I just know that there's another one, and she is elated. She's already bought her tickets. So,
I'm surprised, though, that that entire city's not depressed right now. Have you heard any screams in the last couple hours? Because the Sox are down 0-2 to the Indians in the series, and if they lose today's game in Fenway, they're out, and they're losing 4-2 right now.
I thought it was a little quiet, yeah. And graveyardy. So
That's exactly what it is. Even Brady can make people feel better about the Red Sox. Fucking Cleveland. Also joining us via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. How are you, Elliot?
Are we still on Skype?
Damn it. Damn it. All right. From GChat. I got to change that in the outline, man.
What's up? How are you guys doing? Those of you that, you know, before the show, I literally just ran in here after getting home from work and signed on. So forgive me if I'm rushed and out of breath. But
you're still not too rushed to do that very politely. You know for a fact that we're on GChat, but you asked it like a question.
I was trying to save your face. That's all. Nah. Saving, you know, just trying to, you know, protect your dignity.
The only thing that saves our face right now is Donald Trump, I think. I think he makes us look brilliant by comparison.
Oh, God.
So you want to talk about him and some other shit?
Oh, I guess.
You have to.
All right, let's do it in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Donald Trump has had the week from hell, and yet he is refusing to back down from his Republican presidential campaign. In fact, Trump told CNN that there is a zero chance I'll quit, he said. Of course, the controversy I'm talking about is the groping the certain part of the body controversy, the tape that came out that Trump was speaking with current Today Show host Billy Bush, ironically. And where Trump said some not nice things about women and then also some things that may or may not be construed as sexual assault. But Trump is Trump, and thus Trump will continue trumping. And he is not backing down despite many Republican leaders now asking him to, including third-in-charge Republican Senator John Thune, as well as Senator Mike Lee, Ben Sasse, and many other leading Republicans. In fact, today, Representative Paul Ryan didn't really unendorse him, but he said he would no longer campaign for him or support him. He would just focus on his own race and keeping the House.
And didn't Mitt Romney come out with a statement too?
I think Romney was among them. So it's here's the thing. It's not looking good in terms of establishment support for Trump. And the sort of establishment support for Trump was tenuous at best anyway. And this just doesn't help. What do you think? You're going to now no longer not vote?
If there was something that was going to push me to not vote, it wouldn't be this. I mean, let's just talk about the comments for a second. Exactly what he said. And let's talk about whether they're a big deal or not, whether they're actually sexual assault. And then we can talk about how they sort of influenced the debate. So the exact thing he said was... the quote that everyone's flipping out over was he said, quote, grab her by the pussy, correct?
If I said grab them.
Grab them by the pussy. Oh, so it was a whole group? So he's got, he's like fucking Goro. He can grab four women by the pussy at the same time. And he's strong enough to lift them that way. This clears so many things up. I did not know that Donald Trump was actually Goro. Now this quote makes sense to me.
This, I'm watching, it does feel a little bit like Mortal Kombat, so... I get that totally. Come here.
Get over here.
That's right.
Wouldn't that have been more exciting if he just did that in the middle of the fight to Hillary? And then she just started doing all Sonya Blades moves.
Wow. Not even sure where to go with that.
Well, give us the context of these comments, the context.
Trump was on a TV show with Billy Bush. It was prior, I think, to Trump's appearance on the soap opera Days of Our Lives. And basically the camera was recording, but they didn't really know it was recording, or it was sort of like they weren't on air yet, so they were just sort of bantering back and forth.
Right, it was Access Hollywood. And it was one of these times where when you're on set, sometimes they let the camera roll between takes, and that's what was going on.
There you go. And so they were just bantering back and forth, and Trump was sort of bragging about his sexual conquests and being a womanizer and how if you're rich, you can do anything you want to women. And he said a few things like, I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. Just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything. Blue Bush says, whatever you want. And Trump says his infamous line, grab them by the pussy. You can do anything. So the comments themselves are obviously bad. I mean, it's one of these things where it's like, if you listen to the actual recording of the video, it's Trump being who he is. Like, it's Trump just sort of bragging to this guy, and it's Trump trying to joke, but his jokes don't hit because he's weird and awkward. So I don't know what you think about this, but, you know, like using the phrase over and over again, the title of this edition, that this is locker room talk. Fine, I get that, but it kind of doesn't matter that it's locker room talk. Like, that's not really a defense. It just names it what it is. But that's not going to be convincing for people. I don't know what you think of any of this, Justin.
Well, the first thing is that I agree with what you said, that it's just Trump being Trump. And what I mean by that is, I think it actually puts a finer point on his narcissism. So on the Adam and Drew show, Drew likes to say a lot, Dr. Drew, that all politicians are narcissists. So it's irrelevant that Trump's a narcissist. But I think Trump is a narcissist in the sense that he doesn't care if everyone generally loves him. He wants whoever the person immediately is in front of him, or the group of people immediately in front of him, to love him. Or think he's superior, or think he's the best. So he was saying this to speak to Billy Bush and impress him. Whether that means this is what Trump really thinks, or he thinks this is what would impress Billy Bush, doesn't matter. It's just showing that this is the psychology of someone who desperately needs to impress the people in front of him. I mean, I saw this on The Celebrity Apprentice, where, you know, he fired Adam Carolla for Adam Carolla's management skills and organization skills, basically, which... You're only going to do that if you're trying to tell Adam Carolla you have better management and organization skills than him, which is absolutely absurd because I don't think anybody does. And he fired Penn Jillette for Penn Jillette's creativity and morality because Penn Jillette gave a slogan for a high-end cologne and called it "You Earned It" was the slogan. And Donald Trump said, "Oh no, you know, that's going to be off-putting to people." But he's Donald Trump. Why wouldn't he like that slogan? He only wouldn't like that slogan if he was aware there was a mass audience he was watching and he had to preen for the proletariat. There's a phrase for you. Trump preens for the proletariat. So I think that this is really representative of his need to impress whoever's in front of him. In regards to the locker room talk stuff, I don't think he was using that as an excuse. I think he was using it as an explanation because he did apologize for it. And I don't think he would have apologized if he didn't recognize there was something wrong. I think this is just one of the times where somebody who gets caught playing multiple sides of the fence because you have to say different things to impress all people got caught doing that. So the only thing you can do is explain it and apologize. Now, as for the idea that it's locker room talk itself, yeah, I mean, that was immediately what I thought. It doesn't literally mean in a locker room. It means there's a certain class of guys that talk like this, and it's especially younger guys. This is why I didn't have a lot of friends growing up, a lot of male friends, because they would talk in this way and talk about women this way and talk about sex this way, and it made me really uncomfortable. I mean, I wasn't an objectivist back then. I didn't have a mind-body, you know, balance back then. But I was aware on some level it was there, just like I was aware on some level that reality is objective and the truth about reality is objective. I couldn't name it at that point. I was one of the few people in high school arguing morality is objective. So I wasn't friends with these people because I found it very off-putting. But to me, it's a non-issue. There are greater things that are a problem here than this. But I do think it's important to realize that this is again being used as a Hillary campaign, as another smokescreen about what's really going on. And there are people who are, you know, very concrete bound. My favorite thing is the athletes like Chris Cluey coming out and saying, "Well, nobody talked like that in our locker room." Well, no shit, you're a fucking professional football player. What do you have to focus on? It's not the same thing. So it's when he says locker room talk, he doesn't mean literal locker rooms. It can happen there.
Well, yeah. So, Well, maybe I'll let Elliot weigh in before I go off on Donald Trump.
But well, I do want to hear Elliot what you have to say because I think it's interesting because you have the gay perspective, which is guys talking about other guys, and do they talk about other guys the same way some jackass guys talk about women?
Listen, I have shared locker rooms, you know, working for the Mouse with, you know, some queens with mouths on them that they're just dirty. So, I know that it is possible that there is locker room talk of this magnitude, and stipulating, of course, that it locker room talk is really just kind of a catch-all phrase. But what gets me about this is that he's talking about going after a married woman. And after finding out that she's married, he starts to insult her, talking about how fake her breasts are and all that. So what that says to me, you know, I mean, just for me, like if I were a father or a husband, you know, to a little girl or married to a woman, which, you know, I mean, I that would just absolutely sicken me. And I do notice that the people that kind of are rallying around Trump with this, they tend to be either single guys that are fatherless, or they tend to be one of those gay for Trump's people, Trump peoples that, you know, like Milo Yiannopoulos, among others. They tend to be the ones that really rally around it, because I notice a lot of the guys who are married, who do have little girls, daughters, I mean, they really were disgusted by these comments, because at the end of the day, I mean, imagine if that had been your wife, you know, that Trump had talked about, that he had slandered and said, you know, all those nasty things about her breasts and all that. Imagine that. I mean, that to me, more than anything else, is really what kind of makes me sick. Like, the fact that she was married and turned him down, the fact that she showed moral restraint because she was married and he, you know, deems to insult her, I think that that's a lot more revealing than anything else he said. But to broaden the point a little bit more, this heightens, because again, the issue is not just mainly with Trump. It's also the people that are propping Trump up. They have really rallied around him over a lot of things. And one of the things that keeps coming up, especially when you're talking about the alt-right, which I'm convinced more and more every day is an actual thing, you know, they have come to the same position that many people on the left have come to, which is that words don't mean anything. You know, the left says we should be able to change words to spare feelings because words don't really mean anything anyway. People on the alt-right say, well, you shouldn't be offended by words because words don't mean anything. They're just words. Why does it bother you? And you see that a lot when people try to make the comparison with Trump and Hillary, saying Hillary did this, Hillary did that, and Trump's just saying mean things. You know, what does it matter? They're just words. And to me, I tell them, no, but words do mean things. Words stand for concepts. Words stand for ideas. If he's speaking this, it's because these are ideas that he holds, even if it's just subconscious. He does hold these ideas, and you do have to judge people by the ideas that they espouse, the ideas that they hold.
You took what I said, you said, Elliot, and you pivoted it actually in the same direction I was going to pivot in. So I want to build on what you said, because everything you said is very, very well taken. There's just one minor thing I disagree with you on. I agree with you completely about, you know, the words not having meaning anymore. It's all figurative. And that's the thing about what Trump said. Even when he's saying locker room talk and when he's saying grab them by the pussy, he's not being literal. Like literally grabbing someone by the pussy. I mean, that's why I made the Goro joke. Like, think about just like the logistics of that. Like, it doesn't
now
make sense.
Before you go down this road,
no, I'm
we are literally doing a story later in this show about a guy grabbing a woman in the pussy. So
But that's when we're talking about prepositions here, in versus by. And we can get into that when we go to that story later, which is why that story fits so perfectly with this, because that story's on the opposite side of the aisle. It's so interesting. So the point I'm making, though, is with what Daniel said, very well taken, and we'll address that in more in depth when we get there. This is Trump seeing everything through the screen of do you like Trump or not. So he doesn't devalue the woman and insult her until she's against Trump. If Hillary suddenly was like, I resign, Trump's the better candidate, Trump would have the most glowing things in the world to say about her. Even though the one thing he said he liked about her in the debate is that she doesn't quit and doesn't give up, if she quit and gave up for him, she would be the greatest woman to ever walk the planet Earth. That's the way he is. So words don't have meanings to him because they're just tools for him to get people to like him and be on his side.
And I think if that's true, which I think it's the overwhelmingly likely that it is more of an indictment of Trump than I think the actual phrase that he said.
Correct.
Because it literally means he doesn't even have a modicum of principle. He doesn't even have pragmatism. He has in-the-moment narcissism, which is maybe the worst possible quality you can have as president of the United States. I'm of two minds on this issue overall. One is, well, even before those two minds, I've always hated Donald Trump. I was always never Trump. I will always be never Trump because I believe the word never means something, Ted Cruz. But the two minds I have on this are one, Donald Trump, to me, is a scumbag. This is an indication that he's a scumbag, and there have been no indications otherwise that he's not a scumbag. That being said, I was against Trump for the fact that he believes that tariffs are an economically sound idea, which would destroy the economy.
Yes,
so that alone disqualifies him from being president of the United States. But my second mind on this is I was spending a weekend with Midsider Luke, a good friend of mine. Justin recently met him at my wedding. And like, we're looking at all this, and like, apparently there may be some apprentice tapes of Trump saying some horrible things that Mark Cuban may or may not pay $5 million for to get them. And Luke summed it up very nicely, and he just said, quote, "I guess that's one way to do democracy." Well, it's like, at some point in the future, be able to run for president. I mean, certainly none of us here on this podcast could ever run for public office.
Oh, we gosh, no.
Automatically disqualified from the fact that we are honest human beings who say what we mean and record it on a weekly basis.
Well, I've said shit on the internet in AOL chat rooms that I'd be fucked over, so.
Well, even barring that kind of stuff, just literally like this podcast, all three of us plus James and Katrina and whoever else has been on the podcast,
William,
are disqualified from running from office.
They would just play this audio like of any of our podcasts, and we can't say anything because we'd be like, yeah, this is what we think, this is what we believe. So
even Patreon supporters, not to discourage people from Patreon, but they would be like, you paid money to support this?
Yeah. And so isn't that kind of a sad indictment about where we are politically? Like that it's all about finding this fake ethos-driven stuff and not at all about substance? Not that I'm saying that there isn't substance to the criticism of Donald Trump's sexism, but my point being that it's all this sort of gotcha politics now. Like everything is that. And it's not the fact that he believes in tariffs or the fact that Hillary Clinton wants a more socialist healthcare system or the fact that she wants to tax the top 1% at an astronomically high rate. Like it's all about whether or not she had people killed or whether Trump hates women.
Well, this is a cognate to what Elliot pointed about words not having meaning. What you're essentially talking about, Daniel, is any comment we make, the context will be completely dropped to twist the meaning into whatever they want. And that's what necessarily happens if words don't have meaning. Context does not matter anymore. It's just how people feel about you is all that matters.
Yes, indeed. It's a fake ethos. It has nothing to do with genuine character in the Aristotelian sense. And it has everything to do with the perceived character created by the outside entity, which is a horrifying place to be, actually, culturally.
Yes. And I want to build on to talk about the debate because we've been bashing on Trump a lot. But Hillary actually had the scariest thing to me, the scariest comments in the debate, arguably the scariest comment of the entire presidential election cycle.
And it's going to be tough to trump the one that Trump said, but let's see.
To me, it is. To me, it's horrifying. To me, it's like out of like 1984, any dystopian novel like this comment was out of. Because it's just so revealing of her psychology. And it's revealing in the same sense that you say that Trump has, how did you describe it? You said his ethos is an in-the-moment narcissistic ethos?
Yeah, basically in-the-moment narcissism.
Yeah. I think that, philosophy, not ethos. Yeah, he has an in-the-moment narcissism, and that's what drives him. I think Hillary has a similar narcissism, except it's more historical. And what I mean by that is, where Trump's concerned with whoever is in the immediate vicinity liking him, Clinton's worried about history liking her and her impact on history and how she will be remembered. That's everything that's driven her entire life is, I need to make the world adore me in history. I will be remembered as a great person.
It's an interesting form of secondhandedness.
Correct. And the comment I think that revealed this was, I don't remember what it was an answer to, but she answered a question by saying that this election is the most important election ever because it's not just going to affect the next 4 or 8 years, it's going to affect years down the line. Now, I don't often agree with slang that kids say nowadays, but when she said that, I immediately wanted to stay in your lane. You're running an election for the next 4 years. You don't even know if you're going to be reelected yet. You don't even know if you're going to be elected yet. Your job as president is to do things for the next 4 years if you're elected. You're not only looking beyond 4 years, you're looking beyond 8 years, you're looking beyond 16 years. If that doesn't tell you that's somebody who's looking to fundamentally change the country and the world and control things, I don't know what does. She's just told you, everyone, how much she wants to change things. And if you elect her and it happens, even if it's because you said never Trump and you wanted to vote her in instead, you are complicit in that. After hearing that comment, I would not be surprised if she tried to do what everyone's been afraid of and get rid of like term limits and all that shit. That is a scary fucking comment, man.
Well, did you say that people liked contention between us? Because, I actually agree with you somewhat. But on the other hand, you have lots of folks trying to frame every single election as the most important election in American history. I think she takes it further than most, and I think she takes it further because she believes she can via the Donald Trump opponent. But there's a certain, I've said this before on the podcast, there's a certain manner in which I am far less afraid of Hillary Clinton than I was of Barack Obama. And I think Barack Obama is so more fundamentally ideological than Hillary Clinton.
Well, I think he's likable too, so more he can get more shit done than she can.
Yeah, and she, you know, I'm sorry, he was ideological, and she is very, while sort of concerned about her place in history and wants to be one of the greatest figures of all time, I think she's pragmatic about it. I think it's all about sort of power lust, but in a way that is something we've always dealt with in the United States, sort of you're an average power luster almost. And you see that like in the leaked WikiLeaks emails of her speeches, for instance, where she talks about how great fracking is, and she talks about, you know, the American energy economy and all these things that publicly she's against. But I just think she's pragmatic. Like she even praises free trade in these speeches. Free
what?
Trade. Democrat. What? Even Trump won't praise free trade. And so, she wants the other thing was, yeah, I'm remembering all these very slowly, but the third one is that she said banks should regulate themselves, basically. She's just, to me, an average, if maybe slightly more emphatic pragmatist, which is why I'm less scared. And why I find that less scary, although still scary, I don't disagree with you there, less scary than Trump's comments about when he's president, he's going to put Hillary Clinton in jail. It's like, that's not really the way things work here, Donald. This is not the banana republic of America.
Like, yeah, we have to remind people that despite the allegations, and they are substantive against Hillary, but there have been hearings before Congress, but there really hasn't been a trial. So for Trump, you know, for them to support Trump saying that they're going to put her in jail, they're basically supporting him not following due process and just arresting her when there has not been a trial. Really, there's been a hearing, a congressional hearing.
That's not how the presidency works.
Well, of course not.
Judge, jury, and executioner is the president.
Of course. Well, that's how. But that's besides the point. I mean, the point of it is that it is scary, his view of due process, his lack of understanding of how that works.
Again, that's to me, it doesn't scare me because that's him being flippant. It's just saying that it's trying to impress the people he's trying to impress by saying, you know, they're biased in how they cover this election, and even her, she deserves to be in prison. If he got elected, Justin, he would not put her in prison.
But here's the thing. What if he's being flippant in a room with the attorney general? Like, and he's trying to impress. Do you think the attorney general won't take that as an order?
Oh,
like, when you're president, you don't get to, like, joke around like that.
I agree with you. I watched The Apprentice. It was random nonsense. The 4 years of Donald Trump would be random nonsense. I know exactly what we would get. But that concerns me a lot less than the pragmatism of Hillary wanting to stay in power and change the world as long as possible. We'll get 4 years of Donald Trump random nonsense, that random shit will happen. But that'll be it. It'll be 4 years.
I don't see. You're much more charitable about it than I am, Justin. 4 years of Donald Trump. I mean, because in my mind, he is, and not in the way that we understand it, he is very self-absorbed. And not in the positive, life-affirmative way that we're familiar with. He is the kind of guy, and when people joke about him stamping the Trump logo, you know, on different monuments and stuff like that. But this is a guy who, if he comes into power, it will be about his power. It's not really to do the job of the presidency or to protect the Constitution. If he steps into it, it's really so that he can flex his muscles in a way that he never has before. And especially when you look at the fact that he is tried to use eminent domain. In fact, I think he actually has used it successfully in a couple of cases. And when you look at some of his rhetoric about immigration and the borders, things like that, I don't come away as, you know, as being as charitable as you do about it, Justin, to be honest with you. I think he's very scary in a very different way.
Let me be clear. I agree with everything you just said. 100% everything you just said. But I think that him and Hillary are two sides of the same coin. I just think Hillary's better at Washington and politics, so she's more dangerous. Because I think if Trump gets in office and tries to pull that shit, there's enough checks and balances that he's not going to last beyond 4 years and not make that much of a dent. But I think Hillary is very, very, very good at all of this, better than anyone even realizes she is.
Gary Johnson, 2016.
Gary Johnson.
So
speaking I'm not voting 2016. Vote no. If you saw my Snapchat, vote no 2016.
So speaking of being detached from reality, quite literally, Elon Musk thinks we might be detached from reality.
Oh my goodness.
And others.
And others. He is among a group of Silicon Valley billionaires who are actually spending money now, actually giving a substantial donations to organizations who they want to help them get us out of the matrix. Yes, the Silicon Valley tech billionaires actually believe that we are living in a simulation, and that if humanity wants any chance of survival, we have to figure out how to break ourselves out of the simulation, red pill style. So,
to be fair, it would explain the selection. This is like a test. Like, how much can we make them put up with before they realize this isn't real?
Yes, indeed. In fact, I didn't realize, Musk has said this before, and I think we've even covered it before, but the reason I'm bringing in this story is it's kind of shockingly prevalent, or certainly more prevalent than I would hope among Silicon Valley. In fact, a Bank of America analyst wrote last month that the chances we are living in a Matrix-style fictional world is as high as 50%. 50%.
I mean, that's just saying he doesn't know, isn't it? Like, it could be yes, it could be no. 50%. Look at my analysis.
That's a old man style statistic right there. My grandfather used to say, when I would ask him, what do you think the chances are that I win the lottery? Or that's a dumb question, but let's use that as an example. He would say, well, I think it's 50-50. Either you are or you aren't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What, you said I'm an old man?
Indeed.
Indeed.
And Musk has even said that something like there's only a 1 in a billion chance that we aren't living in a simulation. So where the hell is this coming from, guys? Is this just a fundamentally basic failure of the education system and of philosophy in general? Or is there something else going on here?
Are we sure they're not all stoners? This sounds like something they all like go smoke weed together and come up with this idea.
I'm not 100% not convinced that Elon Musk is a huge stoner, so we'll have to table that for now.
Yeah. I have no evidence. I think we have a certain mid-sider that could probably inquire about that.
That's all we're going to say, because we don't want
to. That's all we'll say. Yeah, we're not going to say any names. But I mean, what gets me is, you know, that it doesn't Elon Musk understand that if he really believes that, then his entire life, his entire work, he's just rendered it meaningless. If we're living in a matrix, then everything he's done with regards to SpaceX, I think he was involved in PayPal, the creation of PayPal with Peter Thiel. I mean, anything and everything that he has done, all the innovations and all of the creative leaps and bounds that he has made, he's rendering it absolutely meaningless if it doesn't actually exist. I don't think he understands that the implications of that, like you're dedicating your life to create value and to create and to innovate. And now you're going to say that the existence from by which you learned and created all of these things, now you're going to say that it doesn't actually exist. I this does not bode well for him.
I like your point, but I'm going to take it a step deeper, Elliot. Are you ready to go down the rabbit hole?
Let's go down the rabbit hole.
So let's assume this is a simulation. This is the Matrix. That means it has to have been created by someone, correct?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
So why would someone let him amass enough wealth and enough power and network with other billionaires to leave the Matrix if they've created the Matrix and want him to live in it?
So you're saying the existence of the thing defeats itself.
Yeah, so I'm essentially saying it's like the Matrix movie where they had to explain how they were able to get out of the Matrix by eventually creating the third characters of the programs. So there were the robots, the humans, and the programs, and the programs fucked with the Matrix enough to undermine the power of the creators, the robots, so the humans could escape, so eventually the humans, robots, and programs could all be equal, because the programs were sick of being subservient to the humans and the robots. So if you're Elon Musk, and you're going to have this theory that thinks you think makes you smarter than everyone else, well, go on the meta level and ask why they're letting you get away with it. There's got to be a third party involved here. There's not only a second party, there's a third party. There's more fucking going on here, Elon Musk, if you really believe this. You want to go down that rabbit hole, watch the movie and figure it out.
I go down a much simpler hole.
Okay, Donald Trump.
Giggity.
Yeah, and that simple thought process is there is no legitimate way for Elon Musk to obtain this knowledge. Meaning, he has no directly perceivable evidence of this. It is purely 100% rationalism. And 100% rationalism is a structure of thought where you can make it as complex as you want and as intricate as you want and as deep as you want. But at the end of the day, you cannot pin any single point of it to reality. Mm-hmm. There is no direct connection to the world in which you live. So I don't even call what Elon Musk has a theory, because a genuine scientific theory has some connection with reality and can be tested in reality. This is Elon Musk writing a fiction novel and nothing else.
Well, you've made my point.
Period.
That was the entire problem with the Matrix itself. The only directly perceivable evidence within the Matrix that they were in the Matrix was deja vu, which was a quote-unquote glitch in the Matrix. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So the only way humans could have known they were in a Matrix is if programs told them. Programs were embodied in the first Matrix by the character of the Prophet? The Oracle. The Oracle. She represented that in the first movie, and then they expanded on that in the later movies.
You know, rationalism is that's one of those concepts that I struggled with. Because, you know, Bill, if you're not clear on the distinction between rationality and rationalism, a lot of people can confuse the two. That was one of the things that I think it took me a long time to finally understand what exactly it was.
Daniel explained it very well, but I'm going to make it very simple. If the things you believe don't have evidence that you can perceive with one of the five senses, you're wrong.
It's rationalistic. Right, I mean, it's rationalism, for instance, to debate how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
Right.
Because you can never actually perceive anything in reality to give you evidence one way or the other. Right. You can come up with complex arguments, but essentially all you're doing is building a structure based on a false first premise, which is one that angels exist. So.
Yes, and Daniel, to answer your question, is it a failure of the education system? It largely is, because in order to teach kids writing, I asked them where they get their information from to describe the world. And it's like one in 50 students can respond with your five senses, which is the correct answer. Because they have to think on their own to come up with that answer, because nobody's ever told them that before.
Yeah, I mean, to get a little philosophical about this, the failure of the education system basically results in a bunch of people grasping at the world with anything they can. And a lot of that is rationalism, but really the fundamental is that people don't understand that there is an independent reality separate from themselves that is objective. So essentially what Musk is participating in, and what these other Silicon Valley people are participating in, is just the modern form of primacy of consciousness. That just what I project out is what is true, not like the other way around.
It's like primacy of synthetic consciousness too. I mean, in a matrix, assuming that they're in a matrix created by an AI. So it's not even like an actual consciousness of a human being. It's primacy of like a computer artificial consciousness.
Well, yeah, it's just him understanding it materialistically because to him, the way that relativists and subjectivists and social constructionists do it, it just comes across as pure nonsense. The idea that we can create the world with language doesn't make sense to him, because that's not his tool. The tool he uses is machines.
Yeah. It's yeah, it's all sort of a sad indictment of philosophy and sort of modern thinking. But anyway, another indictment of modern thinking, but on the other end of things, kind of, is Iran and Islam, at least radical Islam, which is taking over the the world chess championships. This is one of the weirdest stories I think we've done, in the sense that it's so many worlds colliding that I had no idea ever interacted with each other. So here's the basic story.
Well, women in chess? You don't think women are allowed to think?
Yeah, that's where I was going with this. Last week, the FIDE, the International Chess Federation, quietly announced that Iran would host next year's Women's World Chess Championship. So in that clause alone, you have so many things that I didn't know existed, like the International Chess Federation, and that there was a Women's World Chess Championship, and that it's moved around, and that one of the hosts would be Iran.
And that Iran's a country.
I barely knew that part, just barely. But here's the kicker. Having the thing in Iran means the contestants will have to cover their hair with scarves to comply with the modesty laws that fundamentalist clerics put in place after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. But the 2016 champion, who has an unfortunate first name that is spelled exactly like Nazi.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure it's Nazi. Nazi, hey, Kidsey Barnes. Yeah, that's, I'm thinking where it comes from. Nazi, Pekidzi Barnes, a Georgian American, i.e. from Georgia.
Yeah, the country. Country.
The country.
Not
the
state, yeah.
Moved to America.
Not, howdy, you know, y'all.
She's not from Atlanta. has made a morally courageous move. She has said she will skip the competition rather than comply with law that denies women and girls fundamental human rights. Quote, I will not wear a hijab and support women's oppression, even if it means missing one of the most important competitions of my career. All right, first question, guys. I mean, other than what do you think of this, but the first real question, is she sacrificing?
I will not, see?
Slap you. I'll reach through this microphone and just slap you.
I don't know what's going on.
No, it's not a sacrifice if she views her, you know, her right to present herself as she wants to present herself. If she thinks that that's a higher value than participating in the championship, then no, it's not a sacrifice.
It is, in fact, a higher value. Because the freedom...
Sacrifice?
What?
Mm-hmm. People are calling this a sacrifice. That's why I wanted to bring it up. So
no, but this is, as you will hear on our Batman versus Superman episode next week, people are calling his demise a sacrifice as well, when it is not. It is not a sacrifice... what this woman is doing, because it is a more fundamental value. The value of freedom to do what she wants and act as she wants and dress as she wants is what allows her the freedom to be a world-class chess player. If she were in a country that limited her freedoms, she would not be able to achieve what she has achieved. So if she goes against what has made her achievement possible, she is only working towards her achievements no longer existing. And it's a bravo to her for understanding that.
But come on, guys. It's just a headscarf. I mean, what's the big deal?
He's only saying that because Fize is not in the room listening.
No, he's saying that because he knows I'm going to get angry, and he knows he can build off of my anger. Because this is one of the few things that makes me viscerally angry. Look, I live in Southern California. Right? Okay, you know, this is like this and Peyton Manning, okay? Make me viscerally angry. It's not even Peyton Manning, it's Roger Goodell. Like, if Roger Goodell's wife dressed in a hijab, I probably would be in jail for murder right now. No, so I'm in Southern California, and I go out on like a Sunday, and I go to the mall, the outdoor mall, the Spectrum. And, you know, there's all these Arab people there. Is that PC? I don't know. Fuck, they're Arab. They're from the Middle East, right? And there are legitimately a lot of people who have come to America from Iran because they were fleeing the regime. And they come here and they do wonderful things and they're amazing people and they love freedom and I love them. Some of the best people I've met in this country growing up in grad school in California have been from Iran because they understand what they left and what their parents left. because, you know, their parents directly left Iran, so they heard the stories and they understand the value of America. But then there are other people, other Arabs, who these women will walk around in 90 to 100 degree weather in a full black hijab. And I just want to say, what the fuck is wrong with you? You are literally not only causing mental suffering, but physical suffering. Can you imagine? That's like wearing a mascot costume. And I, you know,
it
I
is
guess
a mascot. It's a Muhammad mascot costume.
Yes. And I guess the argument is that women have to cover themselves to control men. Because, you know, like a woman's hair is so sexually enticing that it has to... Is that the argument, Daniel?
Yeah, it's right. The reason they have to cover themselves is because men are weak and cannot control themselves. So if a woman is dressed in a way that is revealing, that she could be raped. And the man would not actually be charged for that thing because the woman enticed him into doing it.
And that's another level of just fucking, like, I just want to be like, what the fuck is wrong with you? I mean, this is, I sent Daniel an article earlier today. 50 million Pakistanis have a mental disorder. This has to be the fucking mental disorder. So not only are you causing yourself suffering physically with all the heat and the heat exhaustion, mentally by covering yourself up, it's because you believe that, one, you're so fucking desirable that men can't control themselves around you, and two, men are so fucking animalistic and non-rational and non-human, subhuman, that we can't control ourselves? Fuck you! And that's why whenever I see someone, I have to walk in the opposite direction because I want to fucking yell at them and ask them what the fuck is wrong with them.
Yes, indeed. I can't remember if I told this story on the podcast or simply in our little chat that we do before the shows, but Faiza also has the same visceral reaction to people wearing hijabs or burqas. And she sort of does it a sarcastic sort of response, which is, she doesn't say this directly to them, but Faiza is very loud. So people tend to hear her anyway. Which, so like they're wearing a hijab, but like a long dress. She'll be like, oh, fucking ankles are showing. She should be stoned to death. Because she's trying to show the hypocrisy of all this, really. That's kind of what really pisses her off about it. But
well, yeah, I don't know if I made that point. You're ultimately doing all of it to, I said suffering, but you're ultimately doing all of it to oppress yourself.
Yes, and that's the other element of this story. That's the other element of this story, which is that the Chess Federation is standing by their decision and actually angry with Nazi for her choice, because they think that choosing to wear a scarf is a beautiful choice and that it's a cultural difference. But that's the mistake here, that it's like, I mean, it's obviously there's a level of degree here, but it is in the same kind of thing as saying that female genital mutilation is simply a cultural thing,
right,
and
right.
That it's beautiful and that women could choose it and that's part of their culture. One, women growing up in that culture don't really have a quote-unquote choice.
Right, that's the difference.
Yes. And that's the thing that gets me when they make comparisons with nuns and other Orthodox Christian religions. You know, they post those memes on Facebook thinking that they're so cute and so clever. And I always have to tell them, like, no, because there's only one religion of all of those pictures. There's only one woman that if she removes her scarf, she'll get stoned to death or set on fire. Or whatever lovely other ways the Islamic culture likes to punish
right.
women. Nuns, they don't go through that. In any other Orthodox Christian group or Buddhist or what other groups where people may wear scarves, they don't go through that the way that Islam puts their women through these punishments. It is not
right.
the same thing at all.
Right. And
if a nun removes her habit, she gets to star in The Sound of Music.
Yes.
That's the way that works.
Oh, I love The Sound of Music.
And maybe it's just because I'm Polish, but wearing a scarf on your head can be beautiful if you have the choice, as Daniel said. I mean, isn't there the stereotype of the little old Eastern European woman who wears the scarf on her head and scarf?
The babushka.
Yeah, it ties it under her neck.
Mm-hmm.
Ties it under her chin, I mean.
If it was genuinely a cultural choice, there would be no issue with it, right?
That's a cultural choice there. No one yells at me. I don't get mad at Eastern European women, Polish women.
Yeah, you kind of do.
Well, that's a different story, but...
Right. Yeah. I was going to say something. Oh, I was going to correct you. That's what I was going to do.
Me?
Yes, indeed.
Don't correct me.
Oh, I'm correcting you. It's from much earlier when you said, when you were talking about Arabs. Technically, Iranians would not be Arabs. Arab would be like Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, Iranians are Persians, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and Persian women are some of the most beautiful women in the world. So don't say I hate Persians.
Indeed they are. So, moving on. Why don't men have any friends? Did you know that you're not supposed to have friends?
I think we addressed this with the Donald Trump story, didn't we?
Indeed, but according to an article in Vice, Why Millions of Men Lose Friends in Their 20s, 2.5 million men in the UK over the age of 18 don't have a close friend that they would discuss a serious life problem with. It's kind of crazy, isn't it? And a study found that in America, adult white heterosexual men have the fewest friends of all other subgroups, and loneliness among men is thought to be a contributing factor to their increasing suicide rates today. So why? Why don't adult male heterosexuals have friends?
I think it has a lot to do with the stereotype of masculinity, and I was being very flippant when I was making the comparison to Trump. But in a way, Trump a lot acts like the stereotypical guy, very callous, very rude in the way that he doesn't come across as empathetic or anything. So I think as guys, we're not taught to socialize in the way that encourages bonding in the long run. Think about the movie I Love You, Man. Like, that movie was making fun of that, but it also made the guys very non-masculine. So I don't think we've ever really defined and properly, and I'm just sort of talking here, so if someone wants to like correct me and refine my thoughts more, I'm just sort of throwing shit against the wall. I don't think we've really defined like the healthy way for guys to interact in a way that is emotional yet still masculine. Because if you get emotional with another guy in any way, it comes across as sort of non-masculine or even gay. Like, I mean, maybe this is part of my problem in general, but like, and you know, again, I'm spitballing, and maybe this has to come with the idea of like any advancement towards a woman is harassment type deal. But sometimes, like, when I'm interested in a girl, I just want to be like, hey, we should, you know, go do this thing over the weekend. But then, like, when I meet a new guy I want to be friends with, I'll be like, hey, we should go do this thing over the weekend. But then when I think of saying it in my head, I'm like, well, that's what I would say exactly to a girl I'm interested in. So am I asking him out? Like, what's the difference? Ah!
I think there are some truths to what you're saying there. It's there is a...
Not totally crazy. Yes.
No, there is a cultural sort of detriment to men that equates emotion with softness or emotion with homosexuality. That's a bad thing about American culture, and I think that's slowly changing, but it needs to change faster and more dramatically. But the other element here is that maybe this is the anti-social justice guy in me, but I just think there's sort of a war on men and masculinity in general that would make them less likely to want to interact with other men. I mean, the number of men I meet now who say that their wife is their best friend, for instance. And I think that comes from the fact that we've been telling men that they're kind of shitty and that women are better. And so why would you hang out with other men if men are just shitty people? Shouldn't you be hanging out with more women? Shouldn't you be hanging out with your wife or girlfriend? Elliot, I'm interested in your perspective on this.
I have a few thoughts on this, and I think that the main thing is I think that there is a percentage of guys who they're, well, as I've said before on the podcast, the ability to formulate relationships in general is on the decline, because culturally, I mean, establishing any kind of relationship, it requires certain skills that we don't develop anymore. The ability to communicate, the ability to listen, you know, the ability to understand what the other person is saying. And I mean, I think that those kind of skills are not really developed anymore. And I think that that's one of the reasons why, in general, friendships are very hard to come by. With respect to men, I do think that there is that element of, you know, not wanting to be confused as, you know, as being gay because you express sincere affection for someone of the same sex. And then it's, unfortunate, you know, that there are guys who feel that way. But I do think, I agree with Dan, that it seems to be changing, especially among younger millennial males. I mean, they have an openness in terms of how they care about their friends that I don't think I've seen in my generation or any of the generations that came before me. That are, you know, I think that they have become much more comfortable in expressing their affection to one another. But I don't know that that's necessarily indicative of a bigger trend. But I think at large, the culture doesn't really promote fostering any kind of friendship. I mean, we operate, the culture operates almost in a malevolent universe premise where we automatically assume the worst about one another. We automatically assume that everybody's out to get us. We automatically assume that everybody wants something and they're not actually genuinely interested in who you are in your friendship. We're mistrustful. So I think at large, the culture, you know, the possibility of friendship is severely decreased.
I am nodding my head furiously in agreement because you, again, went in the direction I was going to go with what you were saying, and you've almost closed the gap between what you and Daniel were saying. And I think the way to close that gap is collectivism. And what I mean by that is, Daniel, you talked about guys don't even want to be friends with other guys because they see them as negative because of the way masculinity has been painted. Yes?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
I actually think it's even deeper than that with what Elliot just said. It's they see them as competition. And what I mean by that is if you look at things collectivistically, so all guys are the same and all girls are the same, that means every guy is always in competition with every other guy for every woman. So it's not, you know, there are different people who are interested in different people. It's literally we're all ranked on a scale from 1 to 350 million or 1 to 7 billion. And it's just you all fight each other to the death until you get what you're capable of getting. So there's not like, you can't like wing each other anymore. You can't be someone's wingman because you know you have different preferences and like different things. It's literally, you know, if there's a hot girl, you both go for her. Even though if you were actually individualistic and saw yourself and the other person individualistically, you might say, oh, hey, I was just talking to this girl and I think you would really get along with her. Or, hey, you know, isn't that girl your type? Everything's, as Elliot said, malevolent. Or, as we've said before, interpersonal hostility.
Yeah. It's really sad, too. I mean, I consider myself among the men in this survey in one regard and then not in another regard. So the regard in which I don't feel it is that I could call up Justin or my friend Dan or Luke or Michael or Elliot and talk about a problem if I had one. If that was in my nature, one, it's not, and two, I don't have problems because I'm perfect. But the way in which I do feel among this group is that, like, there is no one in the DC region outside of where I work that I would just be like, hey, do you want to go do something? No one.
Well, that's what I was just going to, my response to what you said is I feel the same way, but you're on the other coast.
Yeah, there exactly. Literally
is. Like I spend 90% of my time alone. Nobody fucking believes me when I say that.
I do too, or with Fiza. But Fiza and I are hyper independent. Like we love each other, we like each other, and it's fun to hang out. But we also want to be apart. Like we find a value to be apart from one another. And it's hard because there's literally no one who I can say, do you want to go bowling, or do you want to go see a movie, or do you want to go, you know, whatever, get a drink, other than the people I work with. And that's for an incredibly short, limited period of time. You know, maybe like the hour after work or before work or something like that. And that's it. It's crazy.
It is crazy. Trump's crazy. It's all crazy.
We're all mad here.
It all goes back to Trump.
It's a mad, mad. Well, it does all go back to Trump when we're talking about masculinity. And it'll go back
more in high school, I would have more male friends.
Yes, that's what this teaches us. Mm-hmm. And we'll actually address that issue coming up here when we talk in The Hopeful Romantic with JML.
People viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw this
couple reviews real quick. First, I didn't get to watch Westworld, even though I intended to. After the Patriots game yesterday, or when you guys hear this, the Patriots game Sunday, I kind of just passed out for a little bit. I had to... My excitement over Brady returning drained a lot out of me. So I had to recover. And then I just ended up watching football rather than Westworld. Because, as I said to Daniel, there's so many shows nowadays that are so dark, it's sort of, you have to get yourself in a certain mind frame to watch them, frame of mind to watch them. So I don't want to do that. But Daniel, I know you said you tried to watch it with Midsider Luke.
Yes, and Luke's wife, Anna, who is a professional actress. And I'm not going to give a full review because I couldn't make it through one episode. And I couldn't make it through in the same way that I couldn't make it through Orange is the New Black, where it was very naturalistic and you see her pissing on the toilet and I was sort of done with that. I couldn't make it through because it didn't make any goddamn sense. I literally cognitively could not figure out what was going on. I couldn't figure out the sort of themes. It was just sort of sporadic. It was almost just like they took Buckshot and loaded it into the HBO show gun and just fired it at a wall, like almost like a Jackson Pollock.
They didn't use whales or what, dolphins or what was it? South Park orcas? Seals? What
manatees.
Manatees, that's it.
You hit every aquatic animal except for the one they use. No, because Family Guy would make more linear sense than this show made.
Terrifying.
There were like all these characters introduced and then taken out and then killed and then revived and like none of it made sense. And Anna pointed out that the acting seemed terrible. And then when I started watching it, I was like, yeah, this acting is really fucking shitty. Like, other than Anthony Hopkins, who could read a McDonald's menu and I would sit enthralled.
And then order everything on it.
Yes, absolutely. I was just so disappointed by the quality of acting, and the writing was terrible. So I don't understand the obsession with this show at all. I couldn't make it through one episode. None of us could. None of the three of us in the room liked it enough to continue wanting to watch it. In fact, we turned it off and played Settlers of Catan. We were just so sick of watching that shittiness. So that's my review. My review is why? What? Why?
Why World, not Westworld. Why World?
If anyone out there in the Midside likes it and you think that there's just something I didn't get, or maybe I was high, I wasn't, but you know, tweet at Midside and tell us what we're missing. Tell me what I'm missing. Tell me why this show has any redeemable qualities whatsoever other than Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, I love when people send me messages that motivate me to watch something.
Yeah. I mean, I'm willing to be wrong. I'm not, but I'm willing to be.
I'll probably still watch the first episode, so I will follow up to say whether you were right or wrong. But before we move on to some trailers here, I want to talk about Timeless. Quickly, Timeless is a new show on NBC about time travel, and it's a bit weird for me to be saying that I'm reviewing Timeless because I actually have an unpublished manuscript about time travel called Timeless, and there were some weird parallels between this show and my manuscript. Now, I don't want anyone to think I'm paranoid or anything. Clearly, they never read my manuscript. Clearly, it's someone thinking the same way I am about the word timeless. Mm-hmm. So what happened in this show was, it starts in the very beginning where you see the crash of the Hindenburg. And then it goes to the present, and it has this woman who's trying to be a history professor, and her mom's really sick, and her sister's there, and she's having trouble with her work and everything. But then the government comes and is like, you need to come with us right away, because... this guy, and I believe he's played by the Nazi from The Man in the High Castle. What's the main guy, the actor's name? Is it Rupert something?
Sure.
Okay, you know the guy I'm talking about, though, right? The guy who tells Joe what to do and everything?
Yeah. I just don't know names.
Yeah, I don't remember the actor's name either. He takes the time machine, he takes it from a secret lab of like an Elon Musk type guy, and... apparently that's how Elon Musk is going to get out of the Matrix, by the way, is time travel. I guess that's what the show is saying. So he takes it and he goes back to the time of the Hindenburg. So this college professor lady, whose history, by the way, beautiful woman. I've never seen a woman this beautiful teach college history, but that's another thing. Her, a former Delta Force guy whose wife is deceased and died tragically, and one of the black techs who works for the Elon Musk character, go in the time machine. Now, the black guy, now the reason I'm pointing out the fact that he's black is for two reasons. One, the Elon Musk character is also black, and the Elon Musk character...
Racist.
It's very strange. I don't know if they're doing this on purpose, but the Elon Musk character pulls him aside as like, you know why you have to do this, right? He's like, but I don't want to pilot the ship. You know why you have to do it. And it's like, because of your black code with each other? What? Like, it was a very interesting casting choice to make them both black. So they go back in time to the time of the Hindenburg. So, of course, the second reason I point out that he's black is the number of times they played the I'm the indignant black man because we've gone to a point in history where nobody likes black people is ridiculous. And he did say there's literally no point in history I can go to where I'm welcome. So they're going to hit that card the entire series. So what happens is they find out that this guy is going to the evil guy, who we don't know if he's a Nazi or not. He's going to, they figure he's going to stop the crash of the Hindenburg to change history. So they try and stop him from stopping it. And it does in fact land. But they find out his plan was actually to make it land. So he made it land on purpose because... Do you know who was actually supposed to go on the return trip of the Hindenburg to Germany?
Hitler?
No, a lot of great American men like Carnegie.
No.
So a lot of them. So the idea is he was going to crash the Hindenburg on the way back in order to kill all these great men who were influential in the development of America. So it seems as if the villain is using time travel to change the past in order to destroy America. Which was essentially the plot of my book. Which is a little weird. But then there was a twist in this episode. So as I said, if you noticed, they actually did change history by accident. And that was the Hindenburg blew up after it was evacuated on the takeoff, not on the landing. So it didn't change a lot of major things. The major guest star still died, who played a famous reporter. And these three get back to the present, but everything's different. You realize this when the professor goes back to her house and her mom is well and about. And by the way, her mom is played by the woman who played Moira Queen, which was very weird for me.
Oh, my God.
It was like crossover. And
Flashpoint. It's Flashpoint, baby.
It was actually Flashpoint. Yeah, that's a very good point. They could have wrapped this into the Arrowverse and it would have made sense from a Flashpoint perspective. And her sister no longer existed. So she realized, what did we do? So these characters are timeless because they can change the past, but when they travel back to the future, they're not affected by it. I don't know how this is going to affect everything. Yes. What?
Another element of your book.
Yes. Sorry. Correct. I forgot to say that. Yes, that was also the point of my book, which is what made time travel more interesting. And the final element that makes this interesting is the villain showed the professor her diary in the past and said, I have this of yours. And she says, I haven't written this. And he said, you haven't written it yet. So, based upon all of these elements, my official review of this is a 5. The reason it's a 5 is I'm well aware that the only reason I'm like this show and I'm going to continue to watch it is because I'm a time travel nerd. Most people would probably hate this show, and it's not particularly well executed. As I described, there are a lot of annoying things about it, but I can't be objective about this one.
Man, I wish we had time to talk about like the shows that came back, like Flashpoint on The Flash. Because they're also dealing with time travel. I wish we had time to talk about it.
We will discuss that in a few weeks. It's just that they're overlapping their premieres, where The Flash premiered and Arrow premiered last week, and this week now we have Supergirl and Legends of Tomorrow. So I don't think we're getting the full story yet, and we'll have crossovers. So I don't want to just hit those every week, because I think it gets kind of boring. We'll get to those, though.
Yeah.
All right, are you guys ready for some trailer takedown?
I guess we are, yeah.
But before we do, Daniel, Midsider Daniel has a message for you that I'm going to play for you right now.
Daniel T. Richards, I think you're only all right. Also, did you just assume my race? I am triggered!
So my master plan is working, basically, is what he's telling me. Because my master plan is to anger people and create dissension and thus conversation and thus engagement and thus social media dominance.
So you're a nicer version of Milo Yiannopoulos?
That's right. You have fallen right into my master plan. Excellent.
All right, let's do this.
Trailer takedown.
First trailer. The Power Rangers teaser for the reboot for 2017. It's called Discover the Power. Hug it or tackle it?
I am going to tackle this. I don't have the nostalgia for Power Rangers that other people seem to have. And on top of that, it looks like a shitty movie. It's not a shitty trailer, because I think if you're a skillful trailer editor, you can make just about anything look even, you know, somewhat interesting, which is what they did. But really what it is I'm sort of tired of this. We're a ragtag group of misfits who get superpowers and we learn to, save the world kind of story. And they're just shoehorning the Power Rangers brand onto that trite bit of storytelling.
You said exactly what I was going to say. I'm so sick of this misfit shit. Like, why didn't they just, like, keep Jason actually a martial arts expert and keep Kimberly actually a cheerleader? They had to make Kimberly, like, kicked out of the popular group and cuts her hair and becomes a rebel. Like, I don't need everyone to be a misfit. This is the naturalism, right? Remember I said a quote previously on the show where they were going to make it more naturalistic? This is naturalism. Yeah. We're all victims of the world and the culture, and it's out of our control. You're making a story about teenagers getting powers and saving the world and taking control of their lives into this naturalistic. Ugh.
Okay, first of all,
yeah.
Okay, Kimberly was a gymnast, not a cheerleader.
Because fine, I rewrote it. Same difference. If she was why couldn't she have been? Make her black. Make her Simone. What's her last name?
I'm not going to pronounce your last
that
name.
One.
No, but listen. I mean, I'm probably going to hug it because I am nostalgic about Power Rangers. As a kid, I was obsessed with Power Rangers, so I probably will hug this movie. I'll probably see it. But I do agree, because even in the original series, the teenagers, they were not misfits in the original series. In fact, they were popular. Kimberly was popular. Jason, they were well-liked. One of the reasons why they're picked in the original series is because they were well liked, you know, and they knew that they would be a good, and because, you know, they would be a good influence to the rest of the student body.
Yeah.
So
even
I'm,
the misfits, they were nice to the misfits, Bulk and Skull. They weren't like, it wasn't like malevolent misfits. They were like goofy, like, ha ha, you guys are so crazy.
And occasionally heroic, because even Bulk and Skull occasionally had their moments of heroism.
And by the way, in the trailer, I'm pretty sure the guy picking on Billy was either Bulk or Skull. So I think that's going to be really fucking awful when they turn them into the bullies.
Yeah, this is... I don't understand the obsession with naturalism in general, but in particular, naturalism with a story where it's going to make it look goofy because it's naturalistic. It's like one Power Rangers. Like, the bad guy is Rita Repulsa. Like, are they going to fight putties in their naturalistic world?
And they're gonna, and she's gonna be a killer. Like she's actually gonna be like a villainess in this one. Like, she murders people.
It's like, it's supposed to be fun and light and heroic. I mean, it's funny to think of Power Rangers in that sense, but it is. So why do we have to redo it dark and gritty? Like, redo it fun and exciting.
Well, there's an argument to be made culturally, because as you just said, those were the things that inspired kids and why kids loved it, just to see that. And there's an argument to be made about undermining that and undermining people's sense of efficacy through undermining the romantic properties that do exist. Because it may have been shitty romanticism, but it was romanticism.
Yeah, indeed.
All right, next trailer.
Wait, did you say what you're doing?
Yeah, I said I agreed with you that I'm going to tackle it because you said exactly what I said because of the Misfits thing.
Oh, okay.
Like, did you remember VR Troopers and some of the other shows around that time? Oh my god, that made my elementary school life. Power Rangers, VR Troopers. Oh my god, the Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad. Don't even get me started. Oh my god. Okay, go on.
I'm so mainstream here with my Darkwing Duck and DuckTales.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
All right, so this next trailer, I'm just going to come out and say right now, I'm going to hug the fuck out of this show. This is Class. It's a spinoff of Doctor Who that's set in the same school that Clara worked at, who was the Doctor's last companion. Mm-hmm. And it's all about the supernatural alien things that happen in this school. And I will explain in a second, but Daniel.
So I had no idea this was a Doctor Who thing until the very end when Peter Capaldi comes out. And so I'm watching this and all I could think is this is British Power Rangers. Like, what did I just fucking watched Power Rangers. Now we're doing Power Rangers again, but with an accent. So I don't care. Not interested. Tackle.
No, I'm going to hug it. It's Whovian. I'm going to hug it. At least I'm going to at least hug the first few episodes, see how it goes.
I am going to hug this for two reasons. One, it seems very much like Torchwood.
Torchwood High.
Torchwood for teenagers. Down to the fact that, did you notice that it was dubstep over the trailer and it worked?
Yes.
I was just like, oh my god, I've never liked dubstep in my life, but it works for this trailer. Like, everything they did, like, the way it was cut together and then, like, randomly cut to people making out, like, the trailer was just awesome. And then I was already in. And then they put a tag on the trailer. And the tag on the trailer was so meta. When they said, What? It's sort of like the Hellmouth. And I was like, that's it. They said previously this is Buffy for a new generation. They just hung a lantern on it. Done. I'm in. I'm sold.
Okay.
Daniel doesn't care. So let's see if he cares about these next two, because I think they're more up his alley. The first one is Patriots Day. Not about the New England Patriots, even though it is set in Boston. This is about the Boston Bombing Marathon. I didn't get much of the plot, but it does star Mark Wahlberg, of course.
The plot is basically just what happened on the day of the Boston bombing, right?
That's what I took away from it. That's why I said I didn't get much sense of the plot.
Yeah. This is another in the long, in the new sort of genre of movies of dramatizing things that happened fewer than 10 years ago. We just saw Sully.
Yes.
Now, Sully was actually really good.
I know, which undermines the point I'm about to make.
This has the potential to be good. This is the caveat, which is I worry we're going to completely fuck this out. This sort of, let's make movies about things that most people still remember very clearly. This one is a little less interesting to me, just in the sense that it was sort of more contained and smaller scale. Like, I understand that it was a bombing and that people died. Did people die, or at least they were injured?
People died. The poor little boy. He was standing. The bomber placed one of the bombs right next to this precious 8-year-old boy, and that's one of the reasons why I'm probably going to tackle the movie. It's just going to really upset me. I think. I don't know if it's because I'm still fresh over the Pulse shooting, you know, by that jihadi bastard, but I think for me, I'm probably going to skip it because I just don't want it. It's just going to be too much for me.
Is this going to be a new form of catharsis for people? Because we can produce movies like this so quickly in the culture?
It depends.
I mean, imagine just 5 years or something after September 11th, if we'd had a major motion picture that basically reenacted the events of September 11th.
We did.
No, they didn't reenact them in the same way. We had the one about the flight that went down in Pennsylvania, but yes. Not like major CGI with planes flying into buildings and people jumping out of them, etc.
Okay. Well, what about the one with Nick Cage where they were firefighters?
Backdraft?
The backdraft. Nick Cage was not in backdraft. You fucking do not sully backdraft.
I cannot believe I just did that.
That's Kurt Russell. That is a masterpiece. Take that back.
I take it back.
All right, Jesus. Shit.
I knew the minute it left my mouth, I was like, no,
that's almost enough to get kicked out of the midside right there.
I repent of my awful ways.
All right, Jesus, man. Next thing you're going to talk shit about Bloodsport or Roadhouse.
No, my gosh.
Roadhouse.
Yeah, I am Roadhouse? Referencing in an episode of the Adam Carolla Show, Daniel.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
They did that movie with Nick Cage as one of the firemen on the day of 9/11. You don't remember that?
Not at all.
Oh, I never saw it for the reason you're saying. And I think that's the difference I'm going to draw here between like a Sully and an event like this. Like, I don't think Sully, even though it was a big deal and publicized for a while, I don't think it was as culturally and politically relevant. So I'm more okay seeing a movie like that. I'm going to tackle the fuck out of this movie because, like, it's too real. I don't need to see this to feel emotion, to come to terms with it.
Yeah. I have more interest in seeing the movie that was just out that I probably missed in theaters. The movie about the oil spill.
Deepwater Horizon.
Deepwater Horizon. Theaters.
Yeah, thank you. I have more interest in seeing that than I have in seeing this.
And that's the point I was just going to make. Who else is who's in that movie too? Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
I should be the person who loves Mark Wahlberg, right? But it's like 50% of his movies I have no desire to see, and 50% of his movies look awesome.
Yeah. I just... And the other issue that obviously is going to be in this movie is Islam. And I have basically no confidence whatsoever in how Hollywood is going to handle that issue, unless it was directed by Clint Eastwood. So.
Well, I mean, to be fair, you do have Mark Wahlberg, who might advocate just punching them in the face. We don't know.
We don't know, but I'm willing to bet that it's treated worse than it needs to, or I don't know the exact phrase. It's treated in a way that it shouldn't be treated. We're going to get some sort of sympathy for the horrible brothers who did this.
Agreed.
So tackle.
All right, now I'm really interested to see what you say about this last one. So this seems to be Oscar bait, this last picture. It's Jackie, starring Natalie Portman, and it is about Jackie Kennedy, obviously the wife of JFK.
What? I'll let Elliot go first on this one. Oh, I'm sorry, Elliot. Did you have a chance to see...
I have not had a chance to see the trailer, but I will tell you, I love all things about Jackie O. Jackie Onassis Kennedy. Actually, before she was Onassis, she was Jackie Bouvier. I mean, one of my gay pantheon, archetypes. But on the other side, I can't stand Natalie Portman. So I'm just kind of like, why did it have to be her? Why couldn't it have been somebody else?
Because she's an Academy Award winner. They made sure to remind us of that.
She's terrible. I'm sorry, but she's, I just don't like her performance. I really, really don't. I don't like her acting in anything she does, and there's so many other actresses that I think would have been so much better to portray Jackie O, because when you think of Jackie O, I mean, she had grace and she had class and composure. I mean, she was very much the anti-Hillary, you know what I mean? She was very elegant and she just, and very, very put together. And there's so many other actresses that I think could have pulled that off a lot more than Natalie Portman.
In theory, to use that phrase, which I hate, I would totally be down for a movie about and her, her reaction to what happened to JFK and to becoming first lady and losing it all very quickly. That could be a fascinating story. This movie is not that fascinating story. It's just not. One, Natalie Portman, who is the every woman that I hate. She ruins everything she touches, basically. And two, it's not directed by him, but it looks insanely like it's directed by Darren Aronofsky. It's going to be the sort of postmodern, hyper-naturalistic, chaotic, quote-unquote, sensory experience that fucking Black Swan was. And who the fuck starred in Black Swan? Oh, yes, Natalie Portman.
Oh yeah, that's certainly part of what you guys are responding to here. She has this intellectual elitism that comes through in her performances.
Well, it's that sneer. She has a bitchy resting face in every role she does.
Well, that's exactly what I just said. Intellectual elitism.
No, but it's resting bitchy face. Like I was being more concrete than what you were.
There's just no way I will ever enjoy this movie. I know it from watching the trailer where they're doing this sort of postmodern nonsense music with the chaotic scene cuts and the cutting down of America and, you know, how America's... And the other element of this, while I would love to see a movie from Jackie's perspective, I cannot stand the JFK worship side of that.
Like you're hitting all my points, man.
The best president we ever could have had, and he was cut in his prime. And if JFK had lived, the country would be this great, wonderful utopia. Like, it's just so much fucking nonsense. He was not a great human being. He cheated on his wife all the time. Not a great guy. Lied to the country. Was terrible at policy. Just all these things. Like, Jackie is so much more of an interesting character than JFK ever could be. So,
hitting all my points. Seeing it. Mm-hmm. So I was going to say the same thing about Natalie Portman. She just looks very out of place in this. She doesn't look like she has the presence and the charisma and the benevolence that Jackie Kennedy had when you see pictures of her, even though she was married to somebody who wasn't great, so she obviously had her issues. And the second thing is, I just want to touch a little more on what you said about this JFK worship. So my grandmother, Massachusetts born and raised, with an 8th grade education, once said, that's it, her highest level of education is 8th grade, worked in a factory her whole life, once said that the Kennedys are like American royalty. Now, that statement is one of the most horrific things you could ever hear an American say, because it's misunderstanding America on multiple levels. Yeah. Especially being from Massachusetts, the Kennedys are from Massachusetts, they're one of the rich families, they live out on the Cape on Hyannis, which is a very fancy place. And then this trailer, I have a question to ask you about it, Daniel. Mm-hmm. Were you surprised it wasn't called Camelot?
Yeah, I was, because the repeated phrase in the trailer, you know, there will never be another Camelot.
Right, as if fucking JFK was King Arthur and Jackie Kennedy is Guinevere? Like, just fuck off. Like, first of all, I don't want a goddamn monarchy. And second of all, if I did, it's Tom Brady and Giselle. So die. Die in a fire. Get shot from a book depository. Fuck you.
If ever I would leave you, it wouldn't be in summer.
And speaking of which, the other parallel to Timeless between the show and the novel is I'm pretty sure the second episode is going to be going back and trying to stop the assassination of JFK. And in my novel, I had the bad guys try to make the assassination of Reagan successful. So it's really fucking weird, the parallels there.
Good times.
Yeah. So to finish up this romanticism art section is we have to hit something serious here. One of the people we have a big problem with, I do specifically, is the owner of Birth Movies Death, the editor-in-chief, Devin Farsi. He is one of the most outspoken and hateful critics of Zack Snyder. He has attacked him for his objectivism. He's misunderstood the objectivist bent. And he's one of the few people who's actually said the biggest problem is that Superman is not altruistic. And he is a noted SJW, social justice warrior. He is anti-Gabergate. If you remember, he called them terrorists or worse than terrorists. And yeah, he's just all around hateful. Now, the thing about these people is, I know, Daniel, you don't like to psychologize, but I often think that people do this because they're covering up for themselves and they feel some sort of guilt or they have some self-hatred and that they feel because they need to be controlled, everyone else does too. And that's why, you know, Superman can't be as great as he is. I mean, that's the irony of them not even understanding the movie he watched with Batman versus Superman. And I have, in a way, compared him to Tui, Ellsworth Tui, and said he is Zack Snyder's Ellsworth Tui. Well, news broke about him over this past weekend. And the news that broke, and I want to be clear that this was on Twitter, but as a reaction to Donald Trump's comment about grabbing them by the pussy, a woman accused Devin Farsi of rape. And I want to be clear here. this is not just sexual assault if it's true. It's rape, because as I learned from the Stanford swimmer Brock case, that if you have digital penetration, that is considered rape, not just sexual assault. So this is what the woman, and her handle is at SpaceCrone, tweeted at Farsi. Quick question. Do you remember grabbing me by the pussy and bragging to our friends about it, telling them to smell your fingers? She tweeted this on October 9th. On the same day, Farsi replied. And this is what he said. I do not remember this. I can only believe you and beg forgiveness for having been so vile. So what do you think, gentlemen? Do you think he actually did it? Or do you think this is just a case of he's an SJW, he's a feminist, so he has to accept all rape accusations? Because if you notice, he doesn't actually apologize for it. He just says he doesn't remember it and he begs forgiveness.
If he didn't do it, then he is such a committed social justice warrior that he would give up his own reality for someone else's. And I'm not sure which would make him more evil, in my view. So it's sort of hyper damned if you do and really damned if you don't. So, but just a very simplistic reading of it is basically admitting to it.
Why do you think he doesn't remember it? Admitting to it?
Well, because he's saying he doesn't remember it. And to me, even a minor bit of sort of extrapolation there would mean they were drinking because they were at a bar.
Mm-hmm.
So he might have been drunk. But that he believes her when she says he did it and he wants to be forgiven for it.
Right, which is psychologically revealing because that means it's within the realm of possibility in his mind that he could have done something like that.
Yeah. Now, if someone said that about you or me or Elliot, do you think that we would even think it's within the realm of possibility that we would do something like that? Like, let's even say we were drunk. I mean, Justin, never going to be in that position, but like, I've been drunk before in my life, like badly drunk. It never at any point did I have the notion of like, let me eject all of the morality I've ever had in my life and sexually assault someone or do something illegal or whatever it is. Like, you,
I don't even think I've seen you have PDA with your wife.
You have to be the kind of person who could do that thing in order to do it, even when you're drunk.
Right. Alcohol just lowers inhibitions, right? It doesn't make you do things out of character. It just lowers your inhibitions so that you feel free to do things that are already on your mind. So if he was drunk and he did this, that means that he already had the capacity for it.
So this is pretty damning to me.
So then, to me, it's not a surprise, and I'm glad you guys are in agreement here, because when I read this, it's like not exactly an admission, but to me, it's consistent with somebody who would hate Zack Snyder's work so much. To me, the only way you can hate Zack Snyder's work so much and completely miss the point is if you don't miss the point at all, you recognize it, but you have to destroy it because you can't believe that kind of goodness can exist because of the way you are. And if you believe that that kind of goodness exists, that would mean you would have to take personal responsibility for yourself. So he had to attack it as a defense mechanism almost. And this is just, it's sort of like, yeah, I expected this to happen. I didn't think it would ever be revealed, but I kind of knew that this kind of thing was lurking with a character like this. Agree or disagree?
I mean, it's hard to tell the people who are evil but who would like actually themselves force evil upon others, or just, you know, would command it of their government or whatever. So I can't say with any certainty that I had any indication that he would be this kind of person, but you can sort of say the opposite or maybe the inverse, which is that it's not surprising that this kind of person would do this kind of thing.
I guess maybe because I'm a writer, I guess you could argue that I haven't made the disconnect from fiction and reality, because to me, this is no different than learning Tui's backstory in The Fountainhead.
Do you want to enlighten the audience on that?
Well, I was hoping you would help me out a little bit.
Come on, by now.
Fill in the details.
Well, you haven't given anything, so I will fill in the details. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Tui's backstory is essentially that he grew up the weakest and the smallest, and he had to learn to manipulate and get ahead by tearing down greatness because he did not believe he was capable of it himself. Correct?
He's a terrific villain because he basically he plays on people's desire to do what, you know, what we believe to be the right thing, you know, the desire to help, the desire to be benevolent. He preys on that and twists it into something completely awful. You know, he tells that scene where he's telling people, oh, you like music. Well, you know, your pursuit of music, you should shun that. And the fact that you're unhappy without it is what's going to make you more pious. It's what's going to make you a better person. You know, the lack of happiness from doing something that you enjoy is a moral ideal. I mean, he takes people's desire to be moral and he twists it. He perverts the code, the moral code that people live by. And he's an ingenious villain, you know, to read him. And he's original. I don't think that there have been other villains that really of his magnitude, because his villainy is by playing to man's desire to be moral and perverting it and twisting it and manipulating it.
Yeah, and I think Farsi has a bit of that with him as well.
Because well, that's the whole playing... Superman thing, right?
Yes, right. Because he points out the exact reason Superman is bad is because of his morality.
Yes, and yeah. You know, he's but as Elliot said, he's playing on people's desire to help people. And he makes it seem like he wants Superman to be a true hero, even though he's destroying his heroism. And just like Tui, I think this is a point a lot of people miss about Tui. Tui's really only doing it because of his self-absorption in the Trumpian sense. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, he wants to rule. He tells Peter Keating that explicitly. When Peter asks him, why do you do this? He tells him to rule. You can't rule by force, but you can pervert people's moral code and establish yourself as a moral authority where people will constantly turn to you. And that's how you rule people. I mean, and that's one other reason why he's one of the best villains in literature, because he accomplishes that. He even tells Peter Keating, you know, Peter Keating is unable to confront Tui in that scene. He's unable to renounce him or to say that, because by this point, Peter has become so second-handed and so manipulated and corrupted by Tui that even as Tui is explicitly telling him what he's done and how he has broken Peter Keating's spirit, Peter can't help but keep appealing to him for moral guidance. It's brilliantly written.
I think you're missing, though, the second-handedness of Tui. He only wants to rule because ruling is not his base motivation. He only wants to rule because ruling will give him that validation that he is not the weakest as he grew up as. So to him, the only way to the only purpose of greatness is to prove your own greatness by through the eyes of other people. It's not in the same sense that Rourke just wants to be great to create great things.
Fun.
Which is, again, that's Farsi versus Snyder, right?
I'm sure Snyder maybe has heard of Farsi, but doesn't particularly give a crap.
Farsi was on the Justice League set, by the way.
Oh, how'd that happen?
Snyder's been in the same room. Because WB decided to placate these people because of all the shit they talked about Batman versus Superman and Man of Steel, and they thought we had to win them back by cutting our movies differently and by making these people think Justice League is going to be funnier and more fun. And again, what happened? Suicide Squad's getting an extended cut DVD. WB, DC Films, has the opportunity to fill a need in the market that nobody else is recognizing. And they were part of the way there by putting Zack Snyder in charge. And the question is now, will they continue down that path? And will they recognize what's going on with Farsi as a sign of not believing these people? That's what we're going to see what happens.
That is the question. Yes.
Be interesting to see what happens going forward. But I will say this with even more emphasis now. Fuck you, Devin Farsi. You are a fucking asshole.
Amen, all right, brother.
Let's talk a little bit more about Atlas Shrugged in Reddit on Reddit.
Sony stupid, Xbox lame, PC gaming all the way. EA Glow, Steam rocks, God rest for my Firefox. These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma whoring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't host it, but we will repost it.
First Reddit. What piece of fiction should be destroyed and never ever again? I added the ever. And never again see the light of day.
Now, Anna Karenina. Anna Karenina.
Hold on. I love to play a game with threads like this, where I start scrolling down and I predict how soon I will see Atlas Shrugged.
Oh, gosh.
How long did it take?
Not long. It was about the 15th one down. And then there were people ranting about the collective and how she had a group of people in New York City who, you know the story of the collective. And they painted it as this evil thing. Somebody was like, yeah, my friend told me once he met a girl who brought him into the collective and he ran away because he was scared of the cult-like atmosphere.
Okay.
So that means Alice Shrugged should be destroyed, apparently.
Yeah. Elliot, Anna Karenina?
Yeah, and I, for the very same reason why Ayn Rand pretty much described it as an evil book, because, I mean, the it's just the message of it. Its theme is just terrible. You know, the idea that the pursuit of your happiness, you know, it ought to be sacrificed for the good of society, for the good of others, you know, and I just hated it. I only ever read it once, and I just could not stand it. I mean, I think that if there's a book to destroy, it would be that one. Not that I am in favor of destroying any book, period. I don't support book burning or anything like that. But if under the premises of the question, that would be a book that I would absolutely want to see burned.
Yeah, I was going to say Fahrenheit 451.
That'd be ironic.
Yeah, no, just kidding. No, my book, it was limited to fiction because there are many sort of philosophy books that should be burned and never read again by another human being, like The Critique of Pure Reason by Immanuel Kant. But the fiction book that should be destroyed is Ulysses by James Joyce.
Been calling Ulysses, that a book is a loose word.
That is the sort of held up as the gold standard of postmodern naturalistic fiction writing, and it is just immensely disgusting. Like, immensely. Like, even Anna Karenina would have some value in the poetry of the writing, whereas Ulysses does not. Ulysses is literally a book that you must force yourself through, even though there's nothing to enjoy about it, because, quote-unquote, it's great art. And it's held up as the greatest book ever written. It's always in these. At the top of the list of professors rate the greatest books throughout all of world history. And that's always at the top. And it's fucking gross.
They ignore Victor Hugo, but they'll put on James Joyce on those lists, yeah. Which is what really gets me.
Justin, did you have one?
Are you guys going to let me get away with rejecting the premise of the question and saying nothing should be destroyed?
No.
No?
No.
Because I already addressed that. Like, we don't support book burning in literal terms, but...
Ah! Okay, then I'm going to use the word fiction differently than you guys. Mm-hmm. I would just destroy almost all of children's television shows. And I mean, like, if we're talking about, fuck, I can't remember. What's Muno? What the fuck is that thing?
Huh?
What?
I can't fucking remember what it's called now. But that's actually not a bad one. You know, like, the Aquabats show, all that kind of stuff. Like, the stuff they have these kids watch is just, like, the dumbest, most ignorant shit ever. Like, if you're trying to shape a young child's mind, you just don't want them to watch this. It's just awful.
Just have them watch adult things.
They say you're not supposed to because they're not developmentally ready for it.
No, you just put on... they just need a steady diet of Animaniacs and Phineas and Ferb, and your kids will be set for life.
Yeah, but I'm talking like toddlers, 2 to 3 year olds. You guys would be okay with Animaniacs and stuff for them?
Yeah, I would be okay with putting on, you know, whatever for, like, I understand that children's brains are different and need different things, but I plan on exposing my children very early to very mature art. I mean, I'm not going to put on like fucking Aliens or you know, Boogie Nights. Masters of Sex. Right. But like just good movies, good art, like children can be exposed to that. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Better than watching fucking Teletubbies or Dora the Explorer.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. I can't remember the name of it though. But yeah, like Dora the Explorer is a good one. Like that's the most ignorant shit. Like the songs, like say backpack. Oh, here comes Swiper, steal our map. Shut the fuck up.
Are you thinking of Wawa Wubsy?
No. The fucking all the monsters. Muno, Yo Gabba Gabba.
Yo Gabba Gabba.
Yeah. I used to like the kids' response to the Little Einsteins. Because I used to, when I worked, you know, at Hollywood Studios, you know, they were part of that show. And it was cool because they taught music and they were teaching things like time signatures and rhythms and melodies. And they were using classical music as they were telling the story. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, but there are some decent ones. Like the Doozers one is pretty good because it actually teaches people how to like do stuff and problem solve. It'll be like, hey, we're the Doozers and we have this problem. Let's think through how to fix it. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's actually teaching them how to think rationally. But it's still fucking ignorant because it like, because they're children, we have to dumb it down to the dumbest possible level ever. Rather than just exposing them to good shit and getting used to it.
And I did like Blue's Clues growing up.
Otherwise. No, ignorant.
I love Blue's Clues when I was growing up. Oh, my gosh.
That is in the list of things to be destroyed.
I loved it. It was so fun trying to figure out the mystery.
Next right. Reddit.
Yeah, the next Reddit is apparently me explaining to Elliot that Blue's Clues should be destroyed. What's the most simple thing you've ever had to explain to a fully competent adult? This is what I call the Adam Carolla question, because he on a recent episode of Adam and Dr. Drew, the Adam and Dr. Drew show, he ranted about this, didn't he?
I forget what specifically you're referring to, but...
I just listened to it last night at the gym. It was just about having to tell people the same shit over and over again and, like, they never do it type stuff.
Oh, his is sort of things like, you know, like with his pool man. Like, when you leave the pool area, close the pool gate.
Yeah.
Because the children will drown. And then the next day it's open. Yeah. He tells him, close the gate. And the next day it's open. And finally has to say, if you leave it open, I'm docking your pay by $50.
Oh, or the one where he said, you know, next time you guys go to Home Depot, ask me and... I always have stuff I want, so I'll tell you what I want to go. And then somebody sent Matt to Home Depot, and then Matt never asked him about what he wanted from Home Depot. And he went to the guy, well, didn't you know to ask me about Home Depot? He's like, yeah, well, I told Matt. And he's like, well, don't you know that Matt doesn't always do everything you tell him, so you have to, like, really make sure he does it or ask for him?
Yeah. I think I have an unfair answer to this question, which is that I married a woman who was not raised in American culture, and sometimes very nuanced language things especially get the best of her, and I think they're fucking hilarious. But I find myself having to explain very simple things that once she understands them, she's like, oh, well, that makes sense. But like my favorite one as of late is that Fiza has misunderstood signs that have words in them that are the same as American names. So literally two recently have been fucking awesome. She'll love that I'm telling this, I'm sure. One is she saw the sign eat, drink, and be merry. And she was like, who are they talking about?
Mary? Oh, my
God. Yes, like the name Mary. She's like, I will eat, drink, like and be Fiza. Yes.
But see, that's actually, she should use that if she wants to do stand-up.
Well, the other one's even better. It's same thing, though. In our apartment building, we have a 24-hour concierge, and she went down one day and said, we need some work done. Can I speak with Will? What the fuck is Will? It's like, Will, the guy who works down here. I've worked here for 5 years. I've never met a Will. She's like, every fucking day I come down here, there's a sign that says, we'll be back in 15 minutes.
Oh no.
And he's like, what?
Oh no.
And she's like, that's not his name? It's like, no, Fiza, that is not his name.
That's just
an awkward start to a sentence.
In her defense, in her defense, grammar, you know, is important. We will be back.
Yeah, well, her sentence doesn't have good grammar ever. We'll be back in 15 minutes.
Exactly. Well, better grammar would have solved it.
She just thought he was black.
I was thinking it. I'm glad you said it.
So that's I have an unfair answer because I live with a cultural foreigner. So
I think for me, just because of the kind of work that I do, you have people calling that should know things, you know, like they're booking trips to, you know, Punta Cana in the Dominican Republic. And 2 days before they travel, they call and ask, do I need a passport? And you'll be like, yeah, you need a passport. Oh, I didn't know you need a passport. I'm like, well, any international travel, you need a passport.
So they have to cancel their trip?
Yes, their $4,000 trip at an all-inclusive in Punta Cana because they didn't get a passport because they didn't know that they need it, and they're leaving in 3 days. So not only do they have to cancel, they're probably under penalties with the hotel and with the different stuff that they booked. I mean, it's one of those things where you just assume that people know you need a passport for international travel. And then for some reason, people just book these trips and then they forget, oh, I need a passport. Well, yeah, you do. You need a passport.
That's actually similar to mine. It's a more concrete version of mine. And it's just, if you plan a little bit ahead, it makes things easier in the present. Like, stop doing everything, like, immediately in the moment and trying to force your way through it or get other people to fix it. You know, this especially happens at work. It happened at work today, actually, where somebody emailed me and they're like, did you receive this sign? It said you signed for it on August 2nd. I'm like, it's fucking October 10th. Like, why didn't you, like, set up a system ahead of time so that, like, when the sign or banner showed up, I could take a picture of it or tell you what the sign was, and we could put it in a fucking slot for that specific banner or sign so you would know where it is. Instead of just going, hey, this company that ships us signs all the time, well, where's the sign? It says you signed for it. Oh, hold on. Let me just climb up there with a giant pile of signs you have and just go through it till I fucking find the one. And this even manifests in what Elliot just said and in driving, where people don't look ahead and go, oh, look where all the space is in the cars. I'm just going to, oh, here's one today. Two-lane road, merging down to one lane. I'm going the same consistent speed I'm going. Guy in the right-hand lane, his lane's ending, starts merging into me when I'm already fucking there because he didn't plan ahead and say, where are the cars in the other lane? I'm just tired of telling people a little basic organization and forethought. That's all it takes to improve your life a tremendous amount. Though I would argue with if those people who need to know that are fully competent.
Indeed.
All right. What did we learn this trip, gentlemen? Daniel?
I learned that Mark Wahlberg doesn't necessarily make a movie good.
Only half the time.
Yeah, 50% of the time.
Elliot?
I learned that between our references to The Sound of Music and Camelot, I'm having a very positive effect on the both of you discussing more musical theater.
Justin, what did you learn?
That Camelot was a musical?
Oh my goodness. Richard Harris, buddy. Richard Harris as King Arthur.
Who is Richard Harris?
All the gays screamed out and were suddenly silenced.
And the Brits. All the gays and all the Brits.
I said the gays.
I said the gays, Elliot. If you learned something this week, or if you'd like to teach us something this week, like what the hell the redeeming quality is of Westworld, why don't you reach out to us on social media, facebook.com/TheMidSide, Twitter @TheMidSide, Instagram @TheMidSide, Snapchat @TheMidSide. And then you can go to the website. All the podcasts up on the website from forever. So you can go to midside.com or themidside.com/podcast. Look up all the work there. There's also some great writing by Justin. And Justin, you're doing a Survivor thing now, right? What's the Survivor thing you're doing?
Yeah, every episode I'm doing a Survivor podcast where it's a retrospect on the episode I bring on. So far it's been fans. I'm going to try and get a couple former players on the show. where basically we talk about generally how we felt about the episode, and then we talk about the strategy, whether they made good moves or not, and then we talk about the story, what the story, what the editing tells us about the show.
Sounds Survivory, excellent. And then, of course, you can go to iTunes, and you can look up The Midside if you want to subscribe or tell other people to subscribe. That's really the key thing here, is getting other people into the show. We love you, Eddie. You know what's up, but we need other people to know what's up. I mean, look around you. The world is falling apart at our feet. We need to get more people on The Midside here.
Yeah, not we the inside, have awesome not the fans. Outside.
Yeah.
Let's get more awesome people with us.
That's right. We need to rally the troops, circle the wagons around the good parts of the culture.
Vote
defend
no!
Defend it furiously. Vote no. Or Gary Johnson. We need your help with that. You know other cool people? You know other great people who secretly love Zack Snyder, who whisper in the night that there's this film named Watchmen that they secretly love? Or that they think that Superman's way better now? Turn them onto The Midside. Take them over to iTunes or to... the Liberty.me feed. It also has The Midside in it. And
wait, hold on. I want to make a Watchmen reference.
Okay.
Tell them that it's okay that when people ask if they like Watchmen, to whisper yes instead of saying no.
Excellent. Fantastic. And then, of course, the Midsiders who want to go the extra mile, want to help us make more of these, help us free up some of our time to create more content like the Snyder series. You can go to patreon.com/themidside and you can actually choose to give us money. Yes, money, real money. Well, as real as fiat currency gets, that we will use to further the show. You can choose to give us money per episode or per piece of content, whatever you want. It's totally up to you. Any amount you want, ranging from a penny to $1 million. Seriously, it helps a lot. We are so friggin' blessed to have Patreon supporters. It's really an amazing thing, and it helps us keep the lights on.
And for instance, we will have a giveaway next week that it will be concurrent with our release of our Batman versus Superman episode for the Snyder series. And that is possible because of you Patreon supporters.
That's right. Batman versus Superman coming up in the pipeline. All right. Thanks, folks. See you soon. Tell a friend.
This concludes your journey into The Midside. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, like, you know, watching the debate, take a step back and witness the farce, like I did with Snapchat filters.
Have a day!
Sound effect. Okay, that'll probably be the tag.
That was perfect.